Hi, I'm Tom Flynn.
And I'm Lori Feathers.
And welcome to Lost in Redonda.
Hey, Lori, how are you doing today?
Tom, I'm doing well. How about you?
Doing all right. It's early spring now, I guess, in Chicago. My daughter has informed me that every groundhog everywhere failed to see their shadow, and she was very disappointed because she wanted more snow. But yeah, that's kind of where we're at. How's Dallas treating you?
I thought that spring didn't come to Chicago until like Memorial Day. What's going on?
I think it's called climate change. I think that's exactly what we're looking at. Yeah, Chicago winds up in one of those strips on the map that as things get warmer or more erratic, it becomes more temperate, which also means our mosquito season has become absolutely disgusting. So yeah, good times.
We have a special guest today. I'm very excited.
We do. I was going to move us on from our usual weather chat and say hello to Mark. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Lori. How are you? Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So Mark Haber is joining us for our backlist conversation today. He is the director of marketing at Coffee House Press. Prior to that, he was at Brazos Bookstore. And has it been a full year that you've been at Coffee House at this point, or are we approaching the year mark?
We're approaching a year. I think around toward the end of February, I was brought on. So a little less than a year, but we're getting there. We're getting to that year mark. And then I worked remotely for about a month or so, and then became a transplant along with my wife in May. So,
I mean, you made that big move from Houston to the Twin Cities, which is
yeah,
hell of a move.
It is. It is a big, big change. And I love Houston. It was always good to me. It was a great experience. We'd been in Houston about 11 years. I'd been at Brazos for about 10, almost 11. And I think we were just looking for a change. I think a lot of people during the pandemic kind of looked at what they were doing and things were good, but I think we were all ready to kind of move on and do something new and exciting.
So how have things been at Coffee House? I mean, I guess to preface, Coffee House is absolutely one of my favorite presses, does some of my favorite books. When I was a buyer, I would get to that section of the catalog and just pretty much go down the line with like sixes or tens or what have you and demand every arc imaginable. So that's a very, very cool place to be working. Basically, don't dispel my illusions. I'm hoping that it's as good as I think it is.
No, the magic is here. No, absolutely. I mean, there's been a lot of changes, I think, overall in just publishing and really the world and any kind of business you can look at. So there's been a lot of change, but no, the magic is still here. And, you know, I think the quality of the books in Coffee House has remained really, really consistent, and really steady. So even though there was behind the scenes a lot of people leaving and coming on, that aesthetic, that kind of quality, I think it never really suffered. But no, things are going really good. We started last year at what we call our NVLA series, short for novella. So it's a novella series, and we do two novellas a year, so one every season. And it's been great. And we've got one coming out very soon by Kaimin Chang. And it's been really challenging, but in a good way. It's been fun.
And you have quite a budding writing career. Well, I don't even know whether I could say budding at this point, Mark. You've got two acclaimed novels under your belt, and you're about ready to publish your third. So I'm assuming the move has also been good for your writing.
You know what? It has been. I wrote so much when I was in Houston. I kind of had a schedule to time myself to write in the mornings before the bookstore. And retail obviously is different than this is more of like a traditional office job Monday through Friday. So I don't know yet if it's been good for my writing or not, but I think it has been. I think, and this isn't meant to like brag or anything, but I've got this imagination that it's hard to turn down and slow down. So even when life is hectic or there's moves or there's changes, something in me is like, well, find that little window of time to do it. So, and I'm sure at some point that'll dissipate a little bit as I get older, but I'm very lucky that way. And that, I don't want to say I have writer's block, but I've got that thing where it's like, I need the ideas to actually slow down sometimes. So.
And tell us about your book that's going to be released, I think in October. Is this right?
Yeah, October 8th. I just saw yesterday kind of the, I don't know what you'd call it, the proofs of the galley. So I got to see the galley and the back and the blurbs, and Yeah, so it's coming out October 8th. It's called Lesser Ruins. It's bigger than my first two books, probably about twice as big. I think it's just under 300 pages. And I think it's my best book. I'm extremely proud of it. It's got the absurdity and the humor of the first two, but I think the humor comes from a different place. It's a little more heartfelt, a little more, I mean, it's a book about grief, but it's also very, very, I think, joyous. And there's digressions. It's kind of a love letter to literature, just digressions into French literature, Russian literature. And I'm really excited about it. And I was saying a few minutes ago, it's written in kind of three big block paragraphs. So there's three chapters and each one's about 80 or 90 pages.
I'm super excited for this book.
Thank you. I'm extremely proud of it. I really am. I love this book.
You let me know that there's some 19th century Russian stars in it. So that's all I need. I mean, I've read your stuff before, but you got me right there.
I knew I'd get you hooked that way. I knew my way into your heart, Lori. So yeah, you know, you and I both have bonded over Russian literature and translation in general, but writers are brought up because the narrator, I don't want to go on about the book too much, but the book opens, it's about a week after his wife has died. She had a long illness. He sat Shiva and he's Jewish, but he doesn't really know that he is. He's one of these people who's kind of socially or culturally Jewish, but he's not practicing. And so that comes up a little bit in the book about, you know, what does it mean to be Jewish if I never went to a synagogue, I didn't do this and that. But anyways, he's grieving, but he feels like, well, now I've got the time to finish my project, which he started. He was a community college professor, retired, which is a book-length essay on Montaigne, the French philosopher. And so he's obsessed with Montaigne. And a lot of it is flashing back to when he was a professor, not very good, because he would give assignments and then sit and try and work on Montaigne. A flashback to the Berkshires, where he was at an artist residency. Hijinks ensue. So he's like a lot of my characters. He's very, he's kind of a high IQ moron. He's very, very smart, but he's his own worst enemy. And I think I stole that term from Saul Bellow. I love those characters that are very, very smart, but they're their worst enemies. They're just kings at self-sabotage. So it's very ecstatic. The writing just goes and goes. And it's very heartfelt, but I think it's also very absurd and very funny. And it's a love letter to coffee. This is the most caffeinated book you'll ever read.
Wow.
I mean, it is drenched in coffee. Yeah. And he talks about writers and coffee. I mean, Kafka and coffee.
And published by Coffee House.
I know. Seriously. I mean, who would have thought? Yeah, this was accepted before I even knew I would work here. Coming here was very quick. So the manuscript was already accepted. And then I was hired a few months later. But I'm really excited to share it with people. It's one of, you know, publishing is so slow that I've been writing it and gestating it. And I look back at parts of this book that were written when Trump was president, when the pandemic hadn't begun. Whereas the first two, I wrote it kind of in a sprint, much quicker.
And you've seen the cover art?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I love the cover. It's different than the first two, but yet speaks to them. Same designer.
Cool.
So different than the first two, but very similar and it kind of speaks to them.
Well, we'll definitely share both Mark and Coffee House's social handles so that, I mean, I think any of our listeners listening to Mark describe his book will pretty much everything you just said there, 19th century Russians, Montaigne, coffee. I have to imagine that's catnip for all of them. But I was actually going to say, when you're talking about the sort of the weirdness of how slow publishing can move and the distance between the writing and the finishing of a project and its actual release into the world. The first event I ever ran was for Irvin Welsh, and he's a wild card.
I bet.
Very funny guy. But he was asked about, I think it was the book about the chefs, like the sex lives of like undead chefs or something weird like that. One of his odd titles. But he used to live in Chicago. So some of the people at the event knew him from that time and remembered him writing this. And this is several years removed from when he lived in Chicago. So they were asking him, like, why did this take so long? What is it like going on tour for a book that you finished like 2 years ago? And he actually described it as necrophilia.
Oh my.
He felt like he was, he said that it very much feels like I'm committing some sort of obscene act by talking about this thing when I've already got two other books. One is finished, one I'm in the process on, and this is the thing I'm talking about. about. So I'm not claiming that you're having a predilection that direction, Mark, but
no, but it is. It's very strange. And I can look back at parts of the book and I'm like, wow, I mean, I'm still that same person, but I'm also not. I mean, there are parts where the main character is talking about the French countryside in Montaigne's time. And he talks about, you know, a lot of people may think it was a beautiful time with golden meadows, but no, there was plagues left and right. And if you didn't get the plague, you were waiting for the plague. And if you missed that plague, well, there's another plague right around the corner. And I'm writing this and, you know, 6 months later, suddenly we're in a global pandemic. I'm like, wow, I'm looking at this way differently now. Yeah, because the world changes and then you change. And then you kind of look at the book and the book might be the same, but you see it differently. So it is a little bit strange. You feel this book, I don't feel that removed because so much of me is in it. But I could see that happening with other books. Absolutely. Where the distance of time just makes you kind of feel like it's a stranger.
And you're also responsible in a lot of ways for shepherding it into the world even more than you were as an author, right? I mean, like, you're heading up the marketing and working with the sales reps and working with the booksellers in a much more day-to-day profound manner than simply as the author of it trying to like do everything you can to get it out there. So that, I mean, that's very neat. I can't imagine there are too many people who've been in that position. So I hope it's as much fun as it sounds.
It is. And hopefully no one thinks it's too incestuous. And I really do have very much hands off in that we have Laura, who actually worked with us at Brazos. She moved up with us a few months later. And she's the publicist. So she's kind of handling all duties. Like, we had a pre-sales meeting with the reps and she and Jeremy handled it, because to get up there and go, oh, it's my book now, I'll let Laura talk about it and get off the screen and come back on, it just seems kind of awkward. So I'm doing some things, but also to kind of avoid a conflict of interest, I'm not letting Laura is kind of spearheading that.
And I don't think we have to worry about incestuousness in the publishing industry. It's all very much that. Man, I'm just knocking it down with uncomfortable commentary already.
Necrophilia and incest. And yeah.
The question is, based on the rule of three, what is the third one going to be? And I got to tell you, I don't even know what it's going to be. So
waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah. But that's probably in order to get me off of that track, we should probably switch gears and start discussing the backlist title, which is Austerlitz by W.G. Sebald. This was your recommendation, Mark. Why don't you get us started? If you could, like, just kind of give us, it's for those who haven't read Sebald, there is a lot of plot, but to try and describe plot is almost impossible at times. But if you could give the try, and also I guess, like, you threw out a few titles, but why did this one in particular occur to you as a title for us to chat about?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And first of all, had both of you read this before, or to either of you, was it the first time reading Austerlitz?
I'd read it before, but I think it was Laurie's
first time. I hope you liked it, Laurie.
I loved it. It was my first time reading this title. I have read Sebald before, though. But for some reason, I read other things and not this title. So
okay, yeah. So to answer your question, and then I'll talk a little bit about the book. I think I chose this one because I'd read it twice over probably 12 years or something, and I love it. And to me, it's his most accessible book. I think his other ones, the writing is just as good. But once you fall in love with the language and what he's doing, it's very kind of slow and kind of moody. And of course, deep reflections on history and war. But getting a foothold can be challenging, you know, for lots of readers. And Austerlitz has always been kind of my favorite of his, because I feel like it's easier to get a foothold. But yeah, the plot is basically, it's almost like a framed story, like Heart of Darkness, where the story of the narrator is kind of second to the story that he's hearing from this gentleman named Austerlitz. And there's a long kind of opening. This man is traveling and he meets this man named Austerlitz, and they end up kind of meeting over time by accident at first at different places in Europe. I think at first it's in Belgium. I could be wrong. I think Belgium.
Yes, Belgium.
And finally, after a decade or plus apart, they run into each other, I think in London, and Austerlitz basically tells him his story, which is kind of the story of the novel, which is him growing up in Wales. He was adopted. He doesn't really know his story. He doesn't even know that his name is Austerlitz. He finds out later. And suddenly you're kind of transported into World War II and the Holocaust, and these children that were sent out of Nazi-occupied countries to save their lives. Of course, we'll get into the photographs he uses in his books, which, you know, he's known for. But it's kind of this meditation on history, and can you ever escape the history, and do you have to atone for the crimes of the past? it's just a lovely book. And I love what I consider restraint. He has a lot of restraint where he's one of these writers where I don't read him and go, wow, I'm getting ideas. I could kind of borrow this and make it my own. Where I just read and go, I don't know how you do this. It's so beautifully translated and so slow. And it's just, it's a lovely, lovely book. I think it's one of those books. I know it's not good to throw around the word perfect, but it just seems almost like perfect to me. It's just kind of a work of art.
One of the things about Sebald, for listeners that have not read him before, is he integrates a lot of photographs into the book. And I wonder what you think the impact of that is, Mark, on the reading experience and in terms of his authorial choices of, you know, kind of when to highlight a story that he's telling through a picture.
Yeah, he uses these photographs in all his books, and of course they match what he's writing about. They're not just kind of dashed into the book to do it. They connect to the story and the narrative. I don't really know. I don't know if I have an answer to that. It's such a great question. I don't know. There's something very eerie and beautiful about his writing, but also the photographs. And he even speaks about it in the beginning about photographs and how once a photograph is taken, that person is already, they could already be dead when you're looking at someone, or they've moved on. It's a snapshot of time. And so besides using the photographs, he also kind of comments about them toward the beginning of the book. I don't know. I don't know what to say about it, except that it's done in such a way that, you know, you end up, if you are this kind of reader, you Google, oh, does that building still exist? I started looking up buildings that he mentions. I know, of course, there's a lot of writing about architecture in this book. And I think the choices he makes are just really, really original and strong. And I think in lesser hands, it could be a gimmick. And of course, with him, it's not. It speaks to the book, and the book speaks to the pictures. It doesn't even speak to it. It's part of the book. But the narrative and the pictures kind of coexist, I think, wonderfully.
I think coexist is a great way of putting it, because I don't know that there's necessarily correlation per se. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is to a degree,
right.
You know, when there is a photograph of, as suggested, that's to be of Austerlitz as a young boy, there are definitely photographs of some of the buildings mentioned, but the placement or even the occurrence of the photograph isn't necessarily side by side with that particular discussion. And frequently the photographs are so grainy as to be like, as to invite you to stare deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
And the more you stare at them, the less you actually see.
Good point.
And I feel like that's reflective in some ways of even the prose style, which is all these words and all these descriptions and all this information amounting to what precisely? Like, there is narrative flow, there is this progression of ideas, but it's also, I've always had the experience of like not really being sure where I am in the process of reading any of Sebald's work. I think actually Vertigo might have been the most extreme version of that. But there's just something about the interaction of the photographs and the prose that I think really kind of throws the reader into an even more unmoored,
yeah,
uncertain state.
I agree. You can get lost in a Sebald book, and I mean that in a good way, but you do. You feel as a reader sometimes very unmoored. As you said, yeah, the photographs can often connect to what he's talking about, but sometimes they're not placed directly where they are. Or I don't know if either of you caught yourselves doing this, but he describes something and suddenly you want a photo of that. You're like, well, why don't you give me a picture of this thing that you're talking about? I want to see that. Mm-hmm. It's really unique, I think.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Just that he does include photographs of some things, but not others.
Right.
And kind of... it's almost infuriating,
yes,
in a way when as you're saying, you really want to see something and it's not there. No, that's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Austerlitz, the protagonist of the book, is a historian of architecture, which,
yes,
I think is really interesting. And so much of the book I found focused on railway stations and this kind of liminality about a railway station. Of course, it's here in the here and now. It existed in the past, and he talks about the history of some of these places, but it's very much a transition point, right? Like you're already, when you're in a railway station, kind of looking forward to where you're going or where you think or you want the train to take you. And Austerlitz's memory gets triggered in a lot of these different railroad stations around Europe. And it seemed to me that this liminal space issue is such a strong theme of the book. Did you have any thoughts on that, Mark?
I think that's a great point. There is this kind of, and also going back to the architecture, I think there's so much to be said about how humanity builds these buildings with our, enormous egos that we think in our minds, maybe this will last forever. And I think studying architecture is kind of studying photographs or the past or things that, like civilizations, they come and they go, they're built and then they crumble. So I think there's definitely a theme there that ties in with architecture and buildings. And then that liminal kind of space of train stations, it's a fantastic insight. I think that ties in also with what Tom was saying about feeling unmoored, like you're coming and going, but you're never kind of static. You're never in that place. And I think that ties in with the feel of the book, with the themes of the book, whether it's Austerlitz leaving and going to Wales as a child, to both of the protagonists or the narrator and the Austerlitz bumping into each other. Everything is kind of coming and going, and there's nothing that stays in place. And I could be reading more into this than maybe he intended, but there definitely seems to be something about the idea of nothing stays. I was going to ask if either of you had ever read Sergei Shchekvek. He was yes. So it's only a quote. He has this line in a book, and I love, and it just says, "Everything built is the promise of a future ruin." And I love that line because everything you built is really just at some point, So I think that's a great insight though about the train stations and that transitory kind of state in the book.
There's also a brief passage from the very beginning because their first interaction is in Antwerp station, I believe, or at least. And I mean, part of what's interesting. Well, I'll get to that part in a second. But anyway, the passage is on page 12. "The movements of all travelers could be surveyed from the central position occupied by the clock in Antwerp station. And conversely, all travelers had to look up at the clock and were obliged to adjust their activities to its demands. In fact," said Austerlitz, "until the railway timetables were synchronized, the clocks of Lille and Liege did not keep the same time as the clocks of Ghent and Antwerp. And not until they were all standardized around the middle of the 19th century did time truly reign supreme." So there's this notion of time and how time is being regulated by movement, by the needs of travel. And Antwerp station itself was built by Leopold II to be a monument to what Belgium has accomplished, its wealth. But that wealth is made possible by the movement through the railway stations, by that like transit, but also that wealth is built on the backs of slave labor in the Congo. I mean, so like, I don't really think you can, I do think you can overread things. I don't care as much about what an author intends, but I do think that Sebald is trying to open up as many pathways as possible into these notions of movement, of time, of creation and ruin. And that's also, that's also part of what the role I think the photographs play, and as you were saying.
Yeah, and if you think about what you just said, all those things, it's such heavy, eternal thing, time and ruin and movement and civilization, and he's tackling the real big subjects.
There's a line in the book. I'm on page 19 of my edition, that almost echoes that Sergio Shchekvek quote that you talked about, Mark, and it's on the top of 19. "We know by instinct that outsized buildings cast the shadow of their own destruction before them and are designed from the first with an eye to their latter existence as ruins."
Wow. Yeah. That's the same thing. Yeah. Yeah. I think Sergio Shchekvek probably was inspired by that. I bet that's it's the same exact idea. Yeah. Both, I think, written eloquently. One thing I was going to also bring up, or we can bring it up later, is also Sebald as a stylist, his style of writing. And I love, Tom, that you mentioned in an email how you kind of read and discovered, or at least read Javier Marías and Sebald kind of, at the same time. And they've got these long, winding sentences. And I was reading up on Austerlitz, or maybe there was a review or something in the last week or so. that someone compared Sebald to Kafka in the fact of being, I guess you'd say, a stylist. And they said they're very, very easy to read. But it's so deceptive because you can read Sebald and he's not, you're not looking up words. It's very, very fluent. And Kafka also very, very, his writing is very, I don't want to say simple, but it's very approachable. But that's a trick because there's so many things happening. It's so complex. And it obviously inspires conversations like this. But I love that type of writing. And same with Maria's in a lot of ways, that it's very approachable. I don't want to say it's conversational, but it's very easy to read and it lets you in. And then once you're in, it starts to really challenge the reader with ideas and themes and things like that.
I think the conversational point is an interesting one because I do think Sebald's style is far more conversational than Maria's.
Yes.
And in much the same way that the trick, I think, that all three, though, Kafka, Sebald, and Maria's are pulling is that they welcome you into the flow of the language and after a little bit, you look up and realize, wait, what the hell am I actually interacting with here? Like, what's going on? In Maria's case, it might be that the sentence structure was such that you have to flip back two pages to figure out what the entry point was.
Yeah.
But I think for both Sebald and Kafka, it's much more the ideas that they're then, in Kafka, all of a sudden you're trying to parse what the actual, this actual situation is that the narrator is finding themselves in. In Sebald's case, it's notions of time, eternity, mortality, and all that, which really seem to be kind of the cornerstones of what he's writing about. I'd also say that if folks are interested in Sebald or become particularly interested in his style, his unfinished work, Campo Santo, is a really, it's deeply disappointing in the sense that it's unfinished and it's recognizably unfinished, but it does give you some insight into how much he worked over these novels, like how much he worked and rewrote and adjusted and pulled the piece from here and pulled it to here and the kinds of, I mean, he is a real, like a serious, serious stylist in the construction of these works. And Campo Santo is fine. It really does kind of show that it's an early draft of something that he was going to work towards.
Yeah. Yeah. It really, it's so tragic that he died so young in a car accident, I believe. And yeah, it's just, we would have had, I think we were deprived of some incredible works. I have not read that. I know Campo Santos, but I did read A Place in the Country, which, it's kind of 40 pieces of, I forgot exactly what it is. I think it was published before he died. It wasn't posthumous, except in English. It was published after he died. And that's a wonderful book. It doesn't feel unfinished. It's a lovely, lovely book.
Speaking of some of how he deals with time and memory so beautifully, I think 20 years from now, if I never look at this book again, the scene or the thing about it that I'm going to remember is this remarkable episode that Austerlitz has at Liverpool Station in London. And he is again in a train station, the underground. Well, Liverpool is also an overground station, but I forget the exact circumstances, but he kind of gets, they're doing work on it. And he's able to get access to this area that's been closed off because they're going to completely, I guess, demolish this area or renovate it or whatever. And when he sees it, he starts having flashbacks and realizing, I've been here before. I've seen this before. And that's kind of a real pivotal point for him kind of exploring how he got to Wales and his whole history. And it just seems to me, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but these kind of liminal spaces like Liverpool Station also emphasize or highlight the liminal aspect of memory. Because when we're remembering something, of course, we're kind of, I mean, where are we when we're remembering something? You know, if I'm remembering something now, of course, like, yeah, I'm physically sitting here in this chair with a memory, but of course, you know, my brain is somewhere in the past. And this kind of thing about you don't really know where you are in time and space. I just think it's such a lovely thing to explore, but such a tricky, like, metaphysical thing to explore as well, that it's, I would think as a writer, it'd be very hard to articulate, but he does it in such a beautiful way.
I everything you said, 1,000%. Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, that Liverpool station is very pivotal. And it kind of ripples throughout the book, but, yeah, I've never really thought about that. When you're remembering something, where are you kind of at that moment that you're remembering? And I mean, obviously I'm sitting here now, but if I'm remembering, you know, yeah, I mean, I think it's got to be very difficult to write about memory, because it's so, I don't want to say obtuse, but it's, you know, it's ephemeral. It's, you know, and I think you've got to really be a master to kind of handle it well, as Sable does.
I mean, and it's also the case that, I mean, even physically, we don't understand how memory entirely works, right? You know, like, there was a long held idea that across cultures, that it just sort of was a thing that existed in you somewhere, that you would access that memory. And we now know that's not the case, but how do we somehow hold on to it? Just, you know, the mysteries of consciousness and whatnot. But I think also alongside of that, or maybe the other side of the coin that he's addressing, is the idea of forgetting or the forgotten. Austerlitz's journey is one of rediscovery, really. Discovering where he came from, how he ended up in Wales, and what happened to his family. He was part of the Kinders transport, as Mark said, getting kids out of countries that were either being taken over by the Nazis or about to be taken over by the Nazis. And so he lost the people who bore him, the people who raised him for the first part of his life. And as he talks about, even as he talks about architecture and buildings, and even as the narrator reflects back on ones that have since been destroyed or changed or what have you, there is an argument against forgetting that's taking place throughout here. I feel like at one point when I read more Sebald, there was a lot more, or at least I was paying more attention to discussions or arguments around whether or not he was... Because I also read him around the same time that the revelations about Günter Grass came out, that, you know, that his childhood association with the Nazis. There, I felt like there were, and I think there still is in Sebald's studies, a conversation around what is he arguing around morality, around Germany. And I don't know, I can't really engage with that. But I do think that there is a gaping wound that he is almost constantly addressing. Yeah. And I think it might be via this idea of liminal spaces, of memory, of whether or not you can you actually recreate a place, but do you have the right to actually forget a space either?
Yeah. That's great. And I think what you said is really true about forgetting. Like, there's almost like him understanding what happened where he's from, Sebald I'm talking about, right when he was born or before he was born, I think there's probably a wound or a guilt and in forgetting, that he feels like if you forget this, it's almost like a sin, you know, it's something that's wrong. And of course, forgetting and memory are kind of two sides of the same coin, or they're opposites, but they speak to each other. One thing I was going to also bring up, and I didn't think of this until you read that passage, Lori, about the control over our lives and how that kind of came about in the modern world with the clocks and the time being wrong. And suddenly time is accounted for. Everything is kind of organized. And I was just reading a biography. I kind of got into this D.H. Lawrence kick in this past 6 months. I read, I think, Lady Chatterley's Lover after high school. I'm like, oh, okay, it's good. And then something triggered me probably toward the end of last year to read The Rainbow. And I'm like, my mind was blown. I don't know if either of you read The Rainbow, but one of the best books I've ever, it's incredible. Anyways, I'm reading this biography of Lawrence, and during World War I, he's stuck in England. He's stuck there because his books are being banned. He doesn't want to be there, but you couldn't really go anywhere because of war. And then once World War I ends, he leaves and he goes to Italy with his wife. But in the biography, it's talking to him, and I thought this was interesting. Before World War I, you would just cross the border and it's land. You're just walking across land, but suddenly you need this thing called a passport. And suddenly humans are being accounted for. You need to know, you're being tracked in a way. I mean, much more today. We're probably on camera 40 times a day. But I thought that was really interesting that's just, you know, civilization progresses or regresses. You know, everything is accounted for. And suddenly he's in this world where you could cross, you know, from Spain into Italy, and there's no paperwork to be stamped. There's no one asking who you are. Suddenly you're just, well, I'm in another country. And it's just strange, that idea of our lives being kind of controlled by time or by borders.
That's the thing that shows up in Maria's quite a bit, especially through the characters of Wheeler and Rielands, that who actually at one time had the same last name, and the fluency with which you could alter your names at one point in time. I hadn't thought about that, but that's a really good, that's another interesting connection across those two writers.
Yeah, absolutely. And suddenly you're like, oh, you need this thing called a passport. You know, we've, of course, never known anything different, but there was a time not very long ago when there was no need for a passport. Just, well, I'm in Italy now, or I'm in Poland. Didn't matter. So the rainbow is incredible, by the way, guys. And he's not in fashion, D.H. Lawrence, which is kind of makes me love him even more. But the rainbow, like, blew me away.
I'm not sure Lawrence has ever actually been in fashion.
Not really.
I think he's been popular, but whether or not he's been in fashion or especially, there's always been something circling around him. I haven't actually read any of his. I haven't even read Lady Chatterley's. Yeah. So I should probably rectify that at some point.
I think I read Sons and Lovers.
Yes, which I ended up reading that too and loved it. And it's almost like an earlier version or a younger version of The Rainbow, in that it's very much... Sons and Lovers is one boy's kind of childhood growing up to be an adult, and Rainbow is just a bigger expanse. It's kind of three generations of a family. But as much as that turns me off, I'm like, I don't want to care about a it's done. It's almost mystical. I mean, the landscape and the family, and it's incredible. So I keep talking people's ears off about The Rainbow, but.
No, that's wonderful. Yeah. I gotta check that out.
I think this was the last book that was published before Sebald died.
That sounds right. And it's also in the grand tradition of writers getting published in the States by New Directions.
Yep.
And then their big seminal work jumping somewhere else.
Yes. I have a story about that, actually.
Please.
Oh, let's hear it.
Directly with Sebald and Barbara. So Barbara Epler, the publisher of New Directions, she told the story once, probably Winter Institute or BEA or something. And she was saying, you know, Sebald was the nicest guy. And he called her and he goes, look, Barbara, you guys are my publishers. I love New Directions. You guys will always be my publishers, but I can buy a house. Like, I can do this thing. I could, you know, so it's that conundrum of the author going, well, this big publisher could change my life. And so I guess he was kind of asking forgiveness in a way to Barbara, going, look, I love you, but these people, they can do something you can't do. You don't have the pockets to buy me a house and this and stuff, and I can send my daughter to college or whatever. And it's kind of the sad reality of any business, you know? So, but yeah, like you said, New Directions, they get these, you know, Javier Marías, same fate.
Yeah. Although from our reading, I think Laurie, I don't know. I'm not going to speak for you on this one, Laurie. I would argue that Your Face Tomorrow was his seminal work, and New Directions did get it until the backlist, shifts over. But I know that you have Laurie has a very strong fondness, especially for the later Marías.
Thus Bad Begins is my all-time favorite.
Yeah. Nice.
I really love that. But I do think it's fair to say Your Face Tomorrow is his seminal work. I mean, it's, if you had to pick, like, what's the most significant thing that Marías did artistically, I think it's indisputable that it's that. It's just not my personal favorite, but, you know.
Right.
I'm in a total agreement, yeah. Because what he does is like, oh, my gosh. But then if you just want, you know, you could read, Tomorrow in the Battle, Think on Me, or, you know, A Heart So White, whatever. But, I agree completely. So
it raises the question of what would a almost maximalist Sebald book look like?
Oh, my, yeah.
What would that have? What would that have been?
Right.
A three-volume Sebald novel would have been.
When we were talking about how he died tragically at such a young age, the first thing that came to my mind was, oh my God, just like Roberto Bolaño. But I feel like we did get a seminal work from Bolaño with 2666.
Absolutely.
Which I adore that book.
Me too.
But yeah, I guess, you know, I don't know. Austerlitz, I guess, is going to maybe have to stand in for the seminal work that maybe we didn't get from Sebald.
Yeah. And I don't know if he would have gone on to write five or six more kind of 200, 250 page novels, or if he would have ended up writing something, you know, who knows what the future would have held. But yeah, it is interesting to see these similarities and these differences between, you know, really, I think, modern writers that we all love.
So I know, Mark, that Thomas Bernard has been a big influence for you in terms of some of your earlier novels. But I wanted to ask, how do you think that Sebald has influenced your work, if he has?
It's funny because I read writers like Sebald. I'm like, because I don't feel like I'm a subtle writer. I feel like I kind of hit you over the head. My writing is very manic. It's a lot of energy. And I feel like there's a lot of Saul Bellow in my books, hopefully. I mean, that's not me trying to compliment. If I can get that Chicago writer, Tom, if I can get that kind of that rhythm and intensity that his writing has, I don't think I'd ever be on a prose level of Saul Bellow. But a writer like Sebald, I don't know if he influences me or if he's one of these writers that I just kind of stand back in awe and go, wow, you really got that down. Where I can read Thomas Bernhard and go, ooh, I kind of know how I can do that and make it my own, or I get influenced directly. Whereas Sebald, I feel like I just read and I go, maybe in themes a little bit, but I don't know if he's a direct influence. I don't know. He's one of these writers where I just go, he does something that's not in my wheelhouse. You know, his books strike me as very quiet and subtle. And I'm neither of those two, really. You know, yeah. And even with Bernhard, his books are very kind of monologues, and they're very interior, and a style I think I've definitely, you know, borrowed and been influenced by. But I think my writing is a lot more, it's got a lot more silliness and hijinks. Things happen in my books that Bernhard would never do. He's like, that would be silly. Why would I do that? Stupid. And things happen in my books. Like there's actually physical activity. And I think Bernhard's books are very interior, where it's all very psychological. And some things happen, but not a lot. Mostly it's in the mind of the narrator, I think. Yeah, I don't know if he is an influence as much as just a writer I really admire. And hopefully what I'm working on now, I just started something a few months ago, will be a little bit quieter. I'm trying to, in a way, remove the safety net of humor. The humor in my books is never forced. It's just, it comes up. That's how my mind thinks. But I am trying to write something without just going for... I don't want to say the humor for me is low-hanging fruit, because I know for a lot of writers that try and write something funny, it's difficult. And for me, it's always been, I think, pretty easy or effortless. And a lot of people go, oh, I don't even think your books are funny. But what I think is funny in my books has come pretty easily. So I think the challenge is to try and do something a little more with a straight face, like straightforward. So I think Sebald may have an influence in future work. So.
And do you find that, I'm assuming that's a challenge that you've set for yourself, since you say that it kind of your natural reaction is to treat things with some, and I love it, this great wry, dry humor, but I guess to try to kind of change gears has got to be difficult.
It is a little bit difficult. And what it is that it's not me consciously going, because really, I always want to write something organically. Like I don't sit there and go, I want to do this thing now. It's more about I start to do something and I'm catching myself going, I've done that. Like I've done that before. I've done that already. I don't want to do it again. So it's kind of that wanting to avoid repeating yourself, and also getting bored. If you've done something, you feel like you've done it, not to have to revisit it. So after I wrote Lesser Ruins, I wrote a novella that Lesser Ruins and the novella it's titled Ada were both accepted from Coffee House before I was hired. And it'll be in their novella series probably next year or 2026. So talking about a gap between what you write, what you don't. And that book is almost like a cousin to Reinhardt's Garden. It's in a castle. It takes place in like an afternoon and it's absolutely absurd. I mean, it's just an absolute comedy. And I think writing something new, I was like, I don't want to go for the jokes now. I want to try and do something that's a little more, I don't know. I don't want to say the word stoic, where it's me and you can tell it's something that I wrote, but maybe not just relying on trying to be absurd. Yeah. So we'll see. I can't wait to share Ada too. I think Ada's, it's really good. And if you want to hear the premise, I can give it to you in like 20 seconds, but.
Yes, please.
It's you don't know what period it is in Europe, but it's probably in the 15, 1600s. He's this man that rules a country. He's not sure. It's either Bavaria or Saxony. He's not even sure. But his Saxon and Bavarian peasants, he calls them Saxons or Bavarians. He doesn't know. And he's waiting. His father was assassinated. He's a Frenchman. So he's come over and taken over this country that he inherited from his dad. And he hates it. He's a proud Frenchman. He's waiting for this woman named Ada, who he fell in love with in Paris 5 years earlier as a student, to come over the cliffs in her carriage to get to the castle with her husband so he can say, I loved you. We only spent one night together in Paris, but I love you. And I'm going to challenge your husband to a duel. And so the entire book is him waiting to her to come over the mountaintop so he can challenge her husband to a duel and devote his love and life to Ada.
Well, being the Russophobe or Russophile, I should say, that I am, not phobe-phile. Is there a Nabokov thing here going on with Ada?
No, there really isn't. I kept writing, going, okay, I really should change the name. Nothing to do with Nabokov at all. I wish I could say there was, but no, it just, that was the name that stuck. And once it kind of sticks enough, and names are just kind of like, they're placeholders, and they always stay unless it kind of rubs me the wrong way. Then I'm like, well, no, that doesn't feel right. And Ada just always kind of felt right. So I think Ada is here to stay, but nothing to do with Nabokov.
Well, the novella sounds wonderful.
It's I think it's a riot. I can't wait for people to read it in, like, I don't know, 2 years from now. I just want to like print copies and mail it to friends. I'm like, it's really good, but I have to wait. So yeah. So but it is fun to kind of explore something that's a little more kind of serious and maybe even somber. And I touch on that in Lesser Ruins, but it's still got a lot of absurdity and humor too.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And thank you for asking about my writing, guys. I don't want to ever like pontificate and just talk about it. So thanks for listening.
No, as someone that has never really seriously written anything creative, I'm always just amazed at you were talking, Mark, about the fact that you can't shut your ideas off. I guess I've always thought that, like, I just don't really have the wonderful imagination I think it takes to write fiction.
It really is. A lot of people go, well, that's just lazy to say it's imagination, but it really is. There's this, it's funny because I always think I'm very, I'm my best on paper. Like, if people meet me, I'm like, you're going to be disappointed because, you know, my wife is like, Mark, you're a dummy. You can't do this. I'm just this person that does, you know, is bad with directions and everything. And I think you get me at my best when I write, because I feel like my gift is imagination. That's where I'm really strong. And I think if you meet me in person, I'm just like, yeah, it's in the book. The book's better than me. So
we've both met you in person, and that's objectively untrue.
Well, thank you. So yeah. You're very kind. But no, I'm excited, and just being able to talk about these books and translation and how they all kind of talk to each other is it's the magic of literature, you know, of having these friendships where we haven't seen each other in person in years, but having that relationship based on either a book we've read or a conversation we've had is just so much richer than having a conversation with someone about a football game, I think. So,
agreed.
No offense to sports, but.
And it's usually a lot less partisan, I think, talking about books. Sports can be very, you know.
Yeah.
divisive.
Yes, yes.
We need to get some more partisan conversations.
Yeah, Sebald versus Marias, you know, let's go.
I would love TikToks of, I don't know. Yeah, Sebald versus Marias. People complain about Maria showing up at every conversation, every conference about Sebald. Maria shows up and it turns into a Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce.
Oh my God.
I would kill for that. That'd be fantastic.
That would be brilliant.
I've actually really been kind of instigating Trevor over at the Mooksy and the Gripes to do a Dickens versus Trollope.
Wow.
Because I personally think Trollope beats the shit out of Dickens any given day. And I think Trevor thinks that too, but he won't admit it. But I think I think getting a little discussion or debate about that would be an interesting one.
That would be great. Lori, I'm absolutely have never read Trollope. What should I start with? Like, what is it, just a favorite or one that would be maybe a good entryway?
Well, you know, a lot of people start with the series.
Okay.
There's the Barchester series and the Pallister series. But if you want a good standalone, but I don't think that's the best. A lot of people, if they do a standalone, do Can You Forgive Her? But I guess I would go with The Warden, which is the first of the Barchester series. It's, I just think it's a very quiet book, and it's about this rural clergyman, basically, but you keep seeing him and the town he lives in kind of through all of the successive books. Tom, have you ever read Trollope?
I haven't actually.
I haven't either, yeah, at all. Then you will love The Rainbow, Lori. You'll love it.
Okay, I got to read it. Tom mentioned, getting back to Mr. Sebald, I don't want to give him short shrift, but...
Absolutely.
But Tom mentioned kind of this reading Marias and Sebald at the same time and kind of seeing some similarities. I'm kind of hard pressed to think of another author who is reminiscent for me in terms of like Sable. You know, if you like Sable, you'll like this. Tom, why are you laughing?
Because Mark, a thing, I don't think I even prepped you for this when we were first talking about doing the podcast together, but a thing that we usually do at the end of the backlist episodes is books that are similar, books you would recommend, or books that resonate with the book that under discussion, to try and like build out a little bit of a suggested reading list. And I realized that A, I hadn't warned you about it, but B, I hadn't done it myself. So I've actually been spending a little bit of time as we've been talking, sort of like background thinking, okay, associations. And so Lori, for you to bring this up makes my life easier because I can't think of anyone else that like would, that twinning I think makes a lot of sense, Marius and Sebald. I don't know who else to, like, I don't know how to make that, a thruple or make them triplets or whatever. I don't know. I can't think of anyone.
I would, and this is, I think he came up to my mind strictly because he is such a similar writer, would be Sergio Shekvec. As far as mood, I don't think his sentences are kind of as winding or serpentine as like as Sebald, but he's got this mood, and there's kind of a strangeness and an otherness to his books. I've read, I guess, three. He has four or five, I think, in English. But the one is called Darkness, and the other is My Two Worlds. And those are both very, very, I mean, My Two Worlds is just a writer who's at a conference in Brazil and he decides to walk around and he goes to this park and it's all about walking. It's all about, it's really kind of, I guess it does have plot. It's not devoid of plot, but it's about him walking and it gives the Sergio or the narrator an excuse to kind of reflect on things and being in a hotel room, things like that. I'm almost guaranteeing that Chef Jack was influenced by Sebald. I'm almost certain he was.
I mean, I guess stylistically, maybe Juan José Serre a little bit. Scars are the 65 years of, I mean, they also have similar, like what you're talking about, similar constructions in terms of conversation or even when it's interior, it's a conversation within the individual's head. But especially Scars has some meanderings to it that stylistically could kind of fit in a bit in a similar family to Marius and Sebald that way. I feel like that's a bit of a stretch and some folks might dispute that comparison.
Well, I've tried to rate Sayar and I've got Scars. I need to give that a shot because I know people who love him and I've really not ever given him a fair shake about reading his work, but I do have a couple of his titles at home.
What about you, Lori? Anything come to mind?
Yes, but I don't know if it's a very good one.
That's okay. We're forgiving.
I'm going to say, it's going to sound weird, I'm going to say Ishiguro, but only The Unconsoled. None of the other Ishiguro, I think works in my mind. And I think I've read all of Ishiguro's fiction. But yeah, maybe The Unconsoled, because that's, I don't know. Have you guys read that one? That's a weird one.
No, I need to read it. Yeah, he's great. I kind of forget him, I think, because he won the Nobel Prize and he's just always there, but he's such a fantastic writer. Wow, he's great.
A lot of people love him, and I do too, for like his very plot-driven books, like Never Let Me Go, like Clara and the Sun. To a lesser extent, The Remains of the Day. Remains of the Day has some memory stuff in it, but The Unconsoled is a very meandering, and the protagonist, who's a pianist, goes to this foreign country for a concert, and he finds himself in all of these situations where he's got this uncanny feeling that he's remembering these same places.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot of memory and the travel kind of thing about the book. It's a strange one. And it has some odd things about it that Sebald doesn't. But yeah, I think that's the best I'm going to do. I think that
I love it.
I think that there's not a lot of writers like Sebald or a lot of books like this that I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think he's pretty singular.
There's a ghostliness to this work and some of the others that I think Sebald is embracing in a way that others kind of shy away from. I mean, that Austerlitz knows who he is and as he discovers where he's from, but there's also this ambivalence about making any such statement. I think that kind of is in the background, not explicitly stated, but just in the way that it's told and the way that he discovers things. Yeah, I mean, Laurie's, you brought it up a number of times, but the liminality of a lot of the spaces, the way these things are discussed, it's uncomfortable. And for whatever reason, Sebald is very, very good at it and very good at making that work in a way that, I mean, which is the goal, right? To get the reader to feel and react the same way.
Yeah.
So this is this is just an absolutely remarkable book. And I'm very, very glad, Mark, that you made me read it.
Oh my God, thank you. Well, the reason I chose it, as I said, you know, I don't want to, you know, what is perfect? It's all, you know, of course, subjective. But like I said to Laurie, I don't think he's an influence because there's something so crystalline and there's something that's very hard to get at that I just so admire that it's almost like, well, how can I be influenced by he's so good, you know? Yeah, he's really fantastic. He is. And there is something ghostly about his work. I think this book especially.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Before you go, where can people find you and find Coffee House online, especially for the cover reveal and so they can get their pre-orders
in?
Oh,
thank you. Absolutely. Yeah. So I think the we're going to announce our kind of fall books, which my book is part of, in April. But I think I'm going to have a cover reveal. I think Southwest Review out of Dallas is going to do a cover reveal in March, next month, probably early next month. And I'll be in Dallas in April, actually, Laurie. I'll email you and let you know, but I'm going to be there in like mid-April for like a festival that Southwest Review is putting on. My handle is just my name on Instagram. I'm not on Twitter, but I think it's just at Mark Haber. If you type my name, I'm sure I'll come up. Coffeehouse Press is just Coffeehouse Press on Twitter. The same with Instagram. We're actually on TikTok now, you know, so, you know, with the cool kids. And very easy to track down. And coffeehousepress.org is where you can pre-order our books, order our books. Mine and my season's books that I'm part of are not up on our pre-order page yet. They'll be up there in April, I think. But we have lots of good books coming out, poetry, fiction, nonfiction. And this has just been an absolute pleasure. It's so good to see you guys. Even though it's virtual, it's good to see your faces and have such really great conversations. I really relish it.
It was wonderful. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah. Have a great day. Thank you guys. Bye.